Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Let's begin this hour very briefly with a few more samplings from our comments page at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show on the Rupert and James Murdoch hearings before the British Parliament that we were taking live last hour. Dorothy writes, I think it's wonderful to hear executives making gazillions of dollars or pounds a year swearing under oath that they are so incompetent that they know nothing of what's going on in their organizations. So incompetent that the only questions they ask of their underlings is, hey, guy, what's up? Mixter from Greenwich writes, did you notice how many times James Murdoch said, I don't have direct knowledge of that? What kind of parsing is that? Hugh Sansom writes, what hypocrisy. The New York Times is better than the Murdoch press, only insofar as it is more decorous in its misconduct. And enough already from the East Village writes, this is not worth the airtime you're giving it. Live coverage not needed. Digested reporting after the event would be more than enough. Back to our national train wreck, please. Ha, which I think we're about to go to. But finally, Kate from New York City asks, hi, Brian, could you talk about why James Murdoch has an American accent? And we looked it up during the news and got Kate an answer. Here is the answer. Murdoch attended Horace Mann, the private school here in New York City, graduated in 1991. He then studied film and history at Harvard, where he wrote a comic strip for the college's famed satirical magazine, The Harvard Lampoon. So the empire may be in the UK at its heart. The dad, Rupert, may be from Australia, but if you didn't know it before, you know it now. James Murdoch is a product of the New York City private school system and Harvard University. I don't know how that relates to Joel Klein, the former New York City public schools chancellor, now a Murdoch employee, sitting right behind James, and in the shot the whole time, but there you go. And again, I'll give you a choice. Don't like to give you a choice not to listen to the show if you're already listening to us. But the choice is the hearings continue with the Murdochs finishing up now, still going, and expected to finish any minute. And then Rebecca Brooks and other Murdoch officials, if you want to stay with the parliamentary hearings, they are being streamed live, including live video on our website at WNYC.org. Meanwhile, in my interview with Henry Kissinger here 2 weeks ago, he said that the United States needs to reindustrialize. And when I asked him how we're supposed to do that if manufacturers have an incentive to outsource to China and India, where the skilled and unskilled labor are both cheaper, this is what Henry Kissinger said.
As I told you, I am not an expert on this. But Germany has done it by great emphasis on research and by apparent pacts between employers and unions, which have enabled them to maintain an industrial base and a significant export market.
So, does Germany know something that we don't? Do they know the secret to creating jobs? President Obama would like to know. I would like to know. I'm sure you would like to know. Germany has brought down its unemployment rate and grown its economy almost 4% in the last year. How did they do it? And can we follow their example? And in the age of globalization, the large big picture question, can advanced industrialized nations like ours still create good paying jobs? Michael Schumann, Time magazine correspondent who writes the Curious Capitalist blog, joins us now to explain the Germany strategy, how that compares to some other countries' job creation strategies, and what the United States might learn from them. Michael Schumann in Hong Kong, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks a lot.
So he said he wasn't an expert, but did Henry Kissinger characterize the German strategy for growth correctly?
He got the basic of it pretty right, yeah. I mean, what the Germans do is they make really good stuff. And, you know, that sounds like a kind of simplistic answer, but that's really what it's about. I mean, you have factories there that are operating in a very, very, very high-cost environment. The executives in Germany actually told me that labor costs in Germany are higher than they are in the U.S. And the only way to keep a factory going under those kinds of circumstances is to make a product that, when you go out on the market, it commands a high enough price that you can manufacture it in Germany and still make money. And they do that by putting a tremendous amount of effort into R&D, tremendous amount of effort into training their staff and designing their products. They find niches in the global market that where they don't have a lot of competition, and the result is they make BMWs. You know, they make BMWs and not Chevys. Sell a BMW for as much as you sell it, you can manufacture in Germany and make a lot of money.
They make Mercedes. They also make Volkswagen.
They make Mercedes.
Volkswagens, though. So any chance that Chinese people want Fords and Chevys?
Actually, the Chinese people really do want Fords and Chevys because, GM is one of the largest car makers in China, and they manufacture in China. I think what Germany is telling us is that you can keep factories at home if you make the commitment to do it. This is what the German executives told me. They said, the Americans have kind of given up too easily. You can do it if you want to. And that means innovation, and it means training, and it means finding ways of keeping your good staff, not laying them off. You know, another very interesting thing Germany did during the crisis is that instead of having the companies lay off lots of people when the global economy shrank, they allowed companies to put workers on kind of short time. Part-time, and they subsidized the company. So workers were able to make a reasonable amount of money and stay employed, and companies were able to kind of save money in the downturn. And what happened is when the economy picked up, these employees were still connected to their firms, and as business improved, they got reabsorbed into the normal workforce. Henry Kissinger mentioned a pact basically between labor and management, and that's exactly what's happened. The unions have decided that rather than kind of pressing for bigger and bigger wage increases and scaring production out of the country, that, we'll take a little smaller wage increase if you promise to keep the jobs here. So there are ways to do this if everybody's on board, the government, the companies, and the workers.
So are these, in these new relationships and new pacts between employers and unions, are they good high-wage jobs still by American and European standards?
These are still very good jobs. People lead very good middle-class lives. However, you raise a very good point because what's happened, part of the reason why Germany has become so competitive is that they have really kept their labor costs down relative to other countries, especially in Europe. So what's happened is that when you strip out inflation, you find that your middle class in Germany has actually not increased their disposable income in the last decade. So they're able to keep their jobs, they're able to maintain their lifestyles, but they're not necessarily getting any wealthier. And the question I think facing Germany is as the population ages and they get into more things like labor shortages for skilled workers, can they keep that going, or will wage pressure eventually kind of undermine their competitiveness story?
Listeners, you want to get in on this? Anybody with contacts in Germany or from Germany, certainly invited. Anybody else? Because this is one of the most important things we could be talking about. Frankly, more important than whether News Corp hacked in to people's voicemails, horrible as that is. This is the future of the middle class in the United States and in the Western world in general that we're talking about with Michael Schumann here today. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Does Germany have a solution to retaining a more or less Western middle class standard of living on a mass basis, Germany or any other country, that the United States needs to learn from, and perhaps and fast? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And Fabio in Manhattan is calling in on the very point. Hi, Fabio.
Good morning, Brian. Big fan of the show.
Thank
Love
you.
Calling in regularly. I want to say that I think the biggest difference between Germany and the U.S. is the fact that employees actually have to be part of the board of members by law. And when it comes to decisions about profit or employees, of course the employees are going to say, better, let's think about the employees and let's think about the company instead of purely about how much profit can these few guys make by, outsourcing their product to another country. where it just completely messes up the actual system and just worries about the money.
Fabio, thank you for this and all your calls. And Michael Schumann, is he right? Are there union members and officials sitting on corporate boards in Germany in a different way than we see commonly in the United States? And is there any ethos of holding corporate profits to a certain maximum, even if informally, so that more of the profit gets distributed in wages?
Well, you know, a couple of thoughts on that. Yes, I mean, I think labor does have more influence in corporate Germany than they have in corporate America. However, I think what you'll find in Germany that you don't see in the United States, whether people are on the board or not on the board, however it works out, is that you're finding that a lot of these German manufacturers that are being so successful in the global market are actually private companies. A lot of them have a family behind them or a founder. And because of that, they're not really watching what happens week to week, quarter to quarter. They take a longer term view. They're willing to make sacrifices in terms of costs and profits on a very short term basis. I mean, they want to make money, of course, but they don't have this pressure to every quarter put out, you know, bigger and bigger, bigger profit numbers. And that gives them a level of flexibility in dealing with their workers that I think a lot of American listed companies, you know, don't really have in this current environment. So I think what would help in the United States, it is actually some kind of corporate reform, whether it means putting labor people on the board or not. It means finding ways so that shareholders look at the long-term success and prospects of American companies and not just the short-term profits and share price movements. And I think that's been missing in corporate America.
Matt in Prospect Heights, you're on WNYC. Hi, Matt.
Hi there. I'm wondering whether or not if I heard you correctly, whether or not the government of Germany subsidize these companies and, more importantly, the workers during the economic downturn, and whether or not, and it sounded like that was a source of success. And does that speak against the kind of government austerity programs that the Republicans are pushing today? Thanks.
Thank you. Michael?
Well, it was just a different model. I mean, what the U.S. did is basically say, you know, okay, lay everybody off and we'll give them unemployment benefits. And there's unemployment in Germany as well. But what the Germans did during the crisis is say, okay, you know what, don't lay these workers off. Put them on part-time. We will subsidize their salaries so you don't lay them off. And then with this, when the economy picked up, you had a group of people who could just get instantaneously kind of reabsorbed back into the regular workforce. And I think that was a tremendous success. And the other reason it was successful is that because you didn't have a huge spike in unemployment, you didn't have the same kind of drop in demand that you've seen in the U.S. and other countries because of the unemployment, because these people were still employed and still making money and were still attached to their companies. So they had the future prospect of returning to work. And it was made clear to them that they would be returned to work. So I think that program had a couple benefits. You didn't see the big spike of unemployment to the point where all these people had to somehow find new jobs. And then you didn't have the same hit on the demand side from the unemployment. But on the other side of this, to be fair, one thing that Germany did that's kind of behind this whole thing is that, you know, starting about 8 years ago, they added a tremendous amount of flexibility to the labor force. Germany, you know, a decade ago was called the sick man of Europe. They had tremendously high chronic unemployment, and one of the reasons is because the labor market was just too protected. It was too difficult to hire and fire people and too expensive. And Germany actually kind of moved in the more American direction to allow greater labor flexibility, and that is another reason why unemployment's been going down.
We just have a few minutes left with Michael Schumann in Hong Kong, who writes the Curious Capitalist blog for Time magazine, as we're doing kind of a follow-up segment on something that Henry Kissinger brought up when he was on the show the other week about industrialization. I was really asking him about China and whether we need to enact protectionist policies in this country to keep some kind of middle-class wages possible while China and India, with their growing all kinds of sectors, undercut us in terms of wages. And he answered that some Western countries are actually finding a way to keep middle-class production through exports and research, Germany being the prime example. And, Michael, before we run out of time, I mean, the only real concrete example that we've talked about is the German automotive industry, primarily BMW and Mercedes. Are there other industries in Germany, and are there other countries that are also doing something similar or something different that the U.S. could learn from?
Well, sure. I mean, I think in Germany, you know, I met a lot of companies that make stuff that you wouldn't think would be competitive out of a high-cost environment. For example, I went to a power tools maker named Steel. They're quite well known in the industry, and they still make a large number of their high-end chainsaws and things like that. You know, the Chinese make chainsaws, but Steel makes a chainsaw of such quality that they can charge a tremendously high price for it and maintain that manufacturing in Germany. I met a company called Weishaw that makes baking ovens, and the CEO himself said to me, you know what, anybody can make a baking oven. There's nothing particularly complex about it. He charges more for his baking ovens than just about anybody else. And how does he do it? Well, he added on a little iPhone-like touchpad onto his oven. So if you want to make croissants, you just tap the croissant icon, and it sets all the baking temperatures and everything for you. So if you can make a product that is superior to everybody else's product, you can charge a superior price, and it, you know, it doesn't have to be necessarily super high tech. You know, in terms of other countries, I mean, in my kind of reporting around the region is. The countries all seem to have similar attributes that are very good at creating jobs. One is that they tend to actually have relatively flexible labor markets. They tend to have generally strong education systems. They tend to be generally open economies, that doesn't mean exports and imports. It means they're open to foreign investment, and they attract a lot of foreign companies as well. You know, I think what's interesting about what's going on in the United States is that, you know, the U.S. has a lot of these attributes. We kind of underestimate, I think, how competitive the U.S. really is as an economy. It's a great place to invest. It has great skilled workers, great education system. And I think that there are a tremendous number of strengths in the U.S. To build on. And things kind of seem kind of down and bad right now. But, you know, I have hope that the U.S. economy has those strengths that a lot of other countries actually want. And that will eventually lead to, you know, the U.S. economy traditionally creates a lot of jobs, and I have hope that the U.S. economy will return to doing that.
Well, that gives everybody a little bit of hope. And I think we should also mention that Germany's engine is not all good. It, quote, has spewed toxic fumes, as some people say. Because doesn't the rest of Europe think Germany's success comes at their expense, blaming Germany's export economy for the region's economic woes, especially in the south, Italy, Spain, Portugal, Greece, you know, the debt countries? Explain that tension and what you think this means for the future of Europe. Are these southern countries having to accept a lower standard of living because Germany is prospering through exports?
Well, the attitude in the rest of Europe is that basically Germany exports too much, that they're basically so competitive that they've pushed out industry in the rest of Europe. So what you have is that Germany, like China, runs a huge surplus. The German surplus, actually, relative to the size of the economy, is bigger than China's. And that's pushed countries like Spain into very big deficits. And the rest of the region looks at Germany and says, you're subtracting from our growth, you're holding us back. The German attitude on this is that, well, the problem is that you guys aren't competitive enough. And while you were sitting around kind of rolling up debt and building houses you didn't need, we were reforming our economy, we were making our factories better, and you guys didn't do that. So what you see in what's going on in the European debt crisis right now is you have Germany attempting to force other countries to implement reforms in a similar way that they implemented reforms to become more competitive. And it sounds kind of cruel, but in the end, it's kind of the answer for Europe. I mean, if the monetary union is going to survive, the euro is going to survive. If Europe is going to maintain its position in the world economy, the Spains and the Greeces and the Italys have to become more competitive, like Germany has become. And without that, they're in serious trouble. So the German attitude isn't necessarily wrong, but what it means is tremendously painful reform for some of these weaker economies, mm-hmm. like Greece, and that's exactly what you see going on.
All right. Well, one of the most important conversations, as I said before, that I think we could have for the future of the middle class in this country, trying to learn some lessons from Germany and elsewhere, really just scraped the tip of the iceberg. But one important conversation about this anyway for today with Michael Schumann in Hong Kong, who writes the Curious Capitalist blog for Time magazine. Michael, comments coming in on our comments page include John from NYC writing, in Germany, if you're on a vocational educational track, you're in school in the morning and apprenticing at BMW or somewhere in the afternoon. We have dismantled vocational education in this country. That's okay, he writes. We'll all become bond traders. So, listeners, you can continue that conversation and the other related ones at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show related to the segment. And, Michael, once again, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And we move from jobs to debt. We have a fascinating guest coming up next who has written a history of debt and also has a radical proposal for massive debt forgiveness. And this might even mean of your personal debts. Stay with us.